Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
With guest co-hosts.
Impaler WRG.
Vitala Turtle.
QNL.
Anyway. Wait, weren't we talking about Civ at some point?
Yeah, I think maybe we should get back to that.
Episode 75. Our hosts today are Daniel Quick.
I'm still here.
Imran Siddiqui.
Hello.
Kenneth Berlin. Lisa QNL.
Hello.
Makalua.
I'm still crazy.
And of course me, Mark Vitala Turtle Anderson.
Wait, is Makalua a woman too?
Yeah, there's two of us on here.
This is insane.
No, she just has a very high-pitched voice.
Oh my goodness!
I can talk with a high-pitched voice too.
Whether we should never build barracks or never build walls, lost infrastructure while capturing a city, and do friendly spies counter enemy missions.
In the research lab, we talked about all the fun that could be had with hidden nationality on units other than privateers.
And in the Senate, we talked about what to do with planned cities, how to best promote catapults with city raider or barrage, the comparative advantages of banks and groceries, and how do you bump the AI from pleased to friendly.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
Yeah, never build barracks, never build walls. What kind of BS is that? I mean, come on!
That's more like, oh, whoops, I forgot to build walls.
Well, the not building walls kind of makes sense if you're rampaging all over the place like the Mongols.
Well, okay, walls I can understand.
But not building barracks? That's silly.
Yeah.
So it's half makes sense and is half crazy.
The Never Build Barracks thread just came up in July of this year, whereas the Never Build Walls thread was in February of last year. And if you compare the opening posts, they're very similar. Actually, almost word for word, with barracks being substituted for walls. I liked especially the line about, when I stopped building them, be it barracks or walls, back in Civ 2, my games went much better. If that is true, this is not Civilization 2.
Well, you could still be playing it. You never know.
Well, I could truly see that kind of happening with the barracks if some people insisted on building barracks before they built any units. So it was acting as a big barrier for them, and they were producing units way, way too late in the game. They were probably getting attacked too early. So if that person just says, oh, I'm going to go from building nothing but barracks in every city before I even build any units to I'll build units instead of that first barracks, then I could see how that would improve your game. But even better would be build some units, and then when you have some time, build some barracks later.
Yeah, that really begs the question, what's the ideal time to build barracks? Sometimes I'll build them first, and that was back when I was, like, a noble player. I don't know, I end up building them around, like, 1000 BC or so.
Well, I usually, on the first round of cities, I'll build them early. The later ones, I may not get around to it. Because I usually remember to send a unit with my settler to go settle, so I don't need a unit immediately, but then I have however many turns to build the barracks while I'm waiting for the city to grow anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I'll build barracks before I build up my first real army, but I will produce a few units before that for the purposes of scouting, protecting a settler the first time. But by the time I've got, say, 3 cities, I want to start having a barracks in my capital city. And then I don't have a barracks in every city, I just have them in a few strategic high hammer cities that are producing units more often than not.
Oh yeah, makes sense. The walls thing, I'm just getting the impression that it's just, well, I don't know, when do people build walls? Because I remember I used to build it in every city.
When I see a stack of doom coming?
Yeah, I think the walls cost too much for what benefit they provide.
Yeah, early, unless you have stone, that's a little too much. But once you've got stone and later on, and say if you wanted to get in a few castles to help your economy later, then you might build walls. You have to build that for castle.
But that's only after they gave castles a benefit to your economy.
Yeah.
I never end up building enough walls to actually end up building many castles, which always sucks when you're Isabella.
On the thread for Never Build Barracks, my favorite post is the third one, by Lone Wolf, where he basically takes the original post and says, never build buildings.
Well, hey, you don't know. Nomad strategy, it might work.
How many times did you think you came short taking the last enemy city because you didn't build in one more stinking unit instead of a building?
Yeah, he has a point there. He's definitely a conqueror type. It's like, that's the opposite of the builder strategy, that's for sure. It's like, never build any units, you know? It's like, build nothing but buildings. Probably wouldn't work.
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with what everybody's been saying here, with both barracks and regards to walls. Walls on border cities, precarious border cities that might need some assistance, but as was said, before stone, or if you never have stone, getting it in that city can be problematic. It's always helpful if there happen to be some forests you can chop while building those walls. And that's if you, A, think it's going to be a city that you could lose, but also, B, you don't have enough units to be able to defend it from the onslaught, or at least hold them off before you have a chance to build even more units or move more units in. Or you know that the city is likely going to be a target and you're not going to be able to get your army from wherever they happen to be, or one of your armies from wherever they happen to be, in that city to defend it.
And then, ironically, the city gets taken over by enemy culture. My walls are impregnable. Oh, wait, no, we join the other side now. Okay. But seriously, the thing that totally screws over walls is the way catapults work. Everyone's going to bring a stack of doom of catapults at your city anyway, and they're going to knock down all your wall bonus before they attack anyway. So it's like, okay, they're going to attack one turn later. That's all it does for you. Gives me one additional turn to get some reinforcements into the city or build something else in the city later. And I'm like, okay, it took me 3 turns to build the wall. So it's like, I could have spent those 3 turns to build the units now rather than the 1 turn later to rush reinforcements in or try to build a unit desperately to defend the city. So what's the point?
When you're going to have a city like that and it's looking like it's going to be a particular target, if you don't have barracks in it already, if you happen to have some forests to chop and some workers in the area, you could chop those and then get the barracks, and then say if you're still on the slavery civic and the city's had a chance to grow, hopefully you've got catapults by that point. So then in that city that's going to be in siege, try to time it so that you're going to have the catapult there, you know, the turn in between when the enemy civ moves their units in and then when they would be able to attack. So that way you can use the catapults to try to soften. You don't have to try to roll those in from another part of your empire, which could be a little bit on the slow side.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, 9 times out of 10, I just end up building more units instead of walls. It just doesn't cross my mind to actually build a wall.
I think most of the time I start building walls once castles become available, and I'm thinking about my particular border cities. Usually by this point, I've either taken out one AI or part of an AI, and now I've either moved myself to a border with a more powerful AI than myself, or comparable at the very least, or they've done the same. In other words, they've moved towards me. Now we've got kind of this tension. I'm looking at the diplomatic relations. I'm looking at, as we can see in a future post, about the likelihood that even if relations are good, that they could backstab me, and have it so that I've got a decent stack in there.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to defend, and if I'm thinking, that would be helpful to have not only walls in there, but also castles in there. But yeah, most of the time, I would actually rather, do they have the barracks in that city? Good. Start getting some siege units in there, or some other kind of units, so then right away, probably be better, either on the defense or the offense, rather than building a wall.
Infrastructure when you take over a city. So this person called one more round asks what happens when you take over a city, specifically what happens to the buildings and infrastructure.
The answer is each city has a value defined in the XML, some percentage of 100% that determines whether it's going to be destroyed or not. Each building takes a random roll and either it's destroyed or not. Some buildings, like the very earlier ones, have a higher chance of surviving, and more advanced buildings have a more likely chance of being destroyed. And yes, it's excessive.
And wonders are exempt from this, because they're never destroyed.
I believe it was Pascascahos Rafai who noted that in situations like that, running caste system can be of particular use, because the cities would be quite large, and then you'd have a lot of people that wouldn't be able to work anything because you've lost the culture. Whereas if you ran caste system, then you could get yourself unlimited artists, turn all those people into artists, and then, boom, get a lot of that culture back.
Yeah, that is useful.
And after drama, you can just build culture as well.
Yes, both those things combined. To expand on what Ken said, it's from Shannon CT, the CIF4 building infos.xml file, looking specifically for the iConquest prob tag. Whatever value is in there is the percentage of the building surviving when the city is conquered. Of course, needless to say, if you then decide to raise the city, well, apparently even the wonders go when you do that. Gosh darn.
Could I just raise the city and leave just the wonder?
I would like to raise the city and move the pyramids, or whatever it happens to be, to City X of mine. Now, can we get started on that?
And if they raise the holy city of religion, why can't they pick a new one?
They do. It's called a mod.
No, it's called the AI mobs you.
So the way I understand it at this point is that any buildings that generically produce culture destroyed, as Ha said, that's the name, Ha, national wonders get destroyed, unique buildings are not destroyed.
I think unique buildings just revert to their default type. You could never have a unique building of someone else's. That's a good question, though. Are they 100% destroyed, or do they roll the probability of destruction of the base building type and then revert to that?
Tune into the next episode of Modcast where that question will be answered. Cross-promotion.
Let's say that you have a few cities and one that has National Epic has been raised. Could you rebuild National Epic in one other city? I mean, I know the answer already, but just asking.
So tell us the answer then.
I think you can't build it again.
I don't know. I don't lose my city with the National Epic in it.
Yeah, me neither. But I'm talking theoretics here, I guess.
I don't know the answer to that question either. Especially if you've already built the National Epic and or Heroic Epic in one of your cities, you capture a city of an enemy that has their National Epic or Heroic Epic. Does that increase the likelihood that that and the city you just captured will go?
I think it guarantees that it's destroyed.
Yeah, well, that would make sense. Do friendly spies counter enemy missions?
I'm not a good espionage player, so if anybody else uses this extensively, please speak up.
I should turn it off, actually.
I don't normally build spies. I do have espionage enabled. I'm mostly with the passive espionage. I think most of the espionage I use is, A, the passive espionage for the demographics, particularly for the power graph,
but
also espionage if I happen to get a great spy, having it perform an espionage mission with a spy bomb, as it were. But if I'm having a particular problem with spies, and that's especially if, for instance, I'm getting notifications, oh, your plantation has been destroyed, consistently, mostly that, but also if I'm getting a lot of messages such as, ooh, a spy has been discovered lurking around wherever, and of course I'm paraphrasing what the line is, then I might build a few spies, not in all of my cities, but usually my newer cities, those that, for instance, don't even have a courthouse, for example, in it that would have very little, if any, espionage capability in it to help to try to prevent that. Yes, if you have a spy of your own and it's in one of your cities, it is helping counter enemy spies. And as someone points out here, clever handle, one spy or a security bureau in the city is the best defense that you can get. They don't multiply. It is true that the security bureau will give you more espionage points. Obviously, a spy unit itself will give you the espionage points. But most of the time, I've stopped building security bureaus or even intelligence agencies. Maybe just in my games, the AI isn't doing the espionage game, so I don't feel the need to have them. But I find that just the espionage that I get from the palace and the courthouses, I find just having a few spies is quite sufficient for that. And when the AI does decide to pillage resources, likes to go for plantations and pastures, I don't know, why wouldn't target one of my mines, one of my strategic resources?
I usually just go in the cities, and I'm actually using spies to do espionage on someone. I usually just enter the cities and do counter espionage or poison water. Actually, that's pretty much the only thing I do.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Nationality units.
Oh, this is an interesting topic thread.
The Snug is talking about expanding the hidden nationality ability in Civ. I know I use this with privateer units, actually reading another person's thread where he had basically spammed privateers and used them to fund a war with hidden nationality raids on pretty much every AI port city. So I was kind of interested in this topic.
Yeah, he says he wants more of those units in the game, basically.
Yeah, I would love to see more of those units, but I think making them, like, a national unit is a little ridiculous. He sees the berserkers showing up with hidden nationality. See, who are we going to look at?
Yeah, I wonder who they came from.
It's like, hey, Viking civilization, are those berserkers of hidden nationality yours? I'm like, no, they belong to the other...
Yeah, something tells me if that happened in the game, like when Civ 4 was first released, there was a lot of, what color of Incans are you? In multiplayer games, it'll become, what color of Vikes are you?
Yeah, if you wanted to do hidden nationality on something, you'd probably be better off doing it in one of the generic units, so you can't tell what Civ is from.
Or he wants everyone to have berserkers. That's the only other thing I can imagine.
Ooh, I like that option.
He said he might want to have some kind of cavalry that he can go around raiding and pillaging stuff, kind of like a land
privateer.
Some kind of unit like that would be fun for him. Yeah, that does sound kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. It could be like a super spy.
Good point. Maybe there should be a hidden nationality explorer unit. Like, well, you know how you had scouts?
No, that's a good idea.
And then it goes to explorers. And what if there was another one after that that was hidden nationality? It could be, I don't know, like...
Discoverer.
Tourist or something, you know.
Well, now it can't move as fast and has a chance of getting caught, but we do have spy units that can do that.
Yeah, but they're a little bit different. I'm talking like an explorer that people would see. They just say, oh, I don't know whose nationality is.
Yeah.
Who's exploring me? Since explorers can already go into enemy territory. So it's like, it doesn't necessarily belong to the person whose territory he came out of. Maybe he was just going through there, you know?
Yeah, I like that idea. Could even, some civs be a unique unit, only you'd have to compensate for it by having a really cool UV, so.
Well, you couldn't really have it as a unique unit, because then everyone would know who it is from. That would defeat the purpose.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, berserker problem again.
Never mind, I just...
Unless it just showed up as, like, a barbarian warrior to the player.
Ah.
It could be your unique unit, but other players just see a barbarian warrior.
Oh.
But then they'd attack it. Then it would be dead at a turn.
Well, what about other players would see an explorer?
Yeah, and they would be underestimating.
Oh.
All right, this is getting a little too crazy.
As long as the unit wasn't overpowered in terms of defense or offense for the particular area that it appears in, like privateers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. It all needs to be balanced tech-wise.
And as the mean team said, they should not be able to capture cities.
Yeah.
That probably would be bad.
Well, that'd be a little ridiculous.
I got a city in the middle of your place.
Well, how about they capture a city, but then it doesn't become your city? It just becomes, like, a neutral city. Oh, I know. City is automatically burned.
It becomes a hidden nationality city.
Okay. It becomes a neutral city.
I like the Namian team said, or captured cities would have to become barbarian. Oh.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah, either automatically burn or barbarian, or it becomes the neutral civilization, you know?
So it would become Switzerland?
If Switzerland had privateers and ninjas.
What, are you saying they don't?
Clearly they do.
Well, they're landlocked, so...
Clearly they do. The lack of proof is proof enough.
There was a comment in this thread from Lemon Merchant, who says, "A mighty level of mayhem and joy if you could have your unit adopt another civ's nationality. Do something nasty, and then Suri gets blamed for it, for instance. Sort of appeals to my canine female side, if you will." Would Mackie and Lisa like to comment on the accuracy of that?
Oh, ouch. Mean.
That would be awesome.
What Lemon Merchant is describing seems more scavenger and vulture-ish. Whereas if I were to show my canine female side, I would probably just build 3 stacks of doom and attack somebody. That seems more canine to me.
Indeed.
Makalula, how about you?
I just like attacking things, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yay!
If I could do it with sneaky nationality spy things, that would be a lot more satisfying, though. I'm just going to start you two into a war.
Grey Wolf refers to the Fall from Heaven mod, where Dark Elves' World Spell turns all of their units into Hidden Nationality, but I have a hard time envisioning Hidden Nationality for a regular Civ game. Well, we do already have Privateers, so this would just be an extension of that.
Yeah, but whenever you're playing a multiplayer game, it's usually pretty easy to tell where the Privateers are coming from. It's only when you're doing single player that it becomes a huge mystery where the AI goes, where did these Privateers come from? There's only one other person on my continent, but I have no idea.
You know? The AI can't understand things? I'm shocked.
Well, Privateers can come across the ocean.
Yes.
So if you're being attacked by Privateers, it could be someone from the other continent who's just like, I think I'll go and screw with these people. You know? Likely, no. But it's all about plausible deniability.
Yeah, or you can frame someone on your continent, send it across, you're like, oh, there's two people on the continent, let me just cause trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed. So then the other guy's like, wait a minute, everyone in the other continent is still in the Middle Ages.
And you know, it's kind of like with Privateers, it can force some people to have some kind of navy, or at least a navy that can fend Privateers off. They don't have one already if they find that they're being invaded by those. And if you had a land-based hidden nationality unit that could go in and start pillaging, it could be an impetus to say in your back cities, farther away from the potential front, where you often have just enough units in there for happiness cap consideration, to have more of those units in there, rather than just having so many of your units concentrated on particular fronts. It's an interesting idea.
Yes. And this is something people can do with, basically with mods. You can just create the units. You don't have to really do anything other than that. You can try these out, is what I'm saying. You only have to use XML. It's easy to do. This is a piece of cake. It could change the game a lot.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
What to do with planes? I think you should hunt buffalo on them. That's just me, though.
All right.
Ooh, I agree. Buffalo is good eats.
Yeah, I was reading this thread, and I figured out what the guy's problem is. He says, sometimes he farms the planes, but if he has a food resource, he builds cottages on them. And I was like, no, no. If you got food resources and you got mostly planes, so you got to farm the food resources so that you can grow.
He's doing it backwards, you're saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
Don't cottage a food resource.
Yeah, I remember one person saying that a farm on a brown square is just a waste, but I don't know, I do that all the time. It's not the greatest tile ever, but it still works.
Yeah, that can work.
Yeah, and when you play on Tectonics, you get so many plane squares, you're going to have to farm some just to keep up with your food.
Which the poster Bass acknowledged, which basically says, I really only play Tectonics these days. I get these quite a lot. But I hate these tiles, so... But yeah, you do have to farm some of them in situations like that. Hopefully you're settling a city that, even though it's mostly planes, there actually is some sort of food resource there.
Yeah.
And so then to help it grow a little bit more, you can farm them. And then a little bit later on, could change those farms if you were able to get some food for means otherwise. I mean, really later on, like if you could manage to get some sushi or something like that, but that's a really extreme situation.
Yeah.
Other than situations like that, though, I'm surrounded by planes, that's what I'll do. But if planes are just kind of here, there, and everywhere, workshops.
Yeah. Around mid-game, I usually switch to workshops from either farms or even cottages that can grow.
I do agree with those in the thread that if planes is adjacent to a river, in which case it already has a goal, depending upon what else is in the city, it could easily go cottage or workshop.
What about watermill?
Oh, those? People are iffy on those a lot, I think. Not everyone builds those.
Yeah, and their later game availability. If you were starting in a more modern age where you would have access to those more quickly, I might build more of those.
Right.
Watermills or even windmills, that was also suggested in here with regards to Hill's plane. Now, those are nice for production.
Yes.
They are nice. Mine those right away.
Yeah, pop a mine on those.
And as someone also said, you could also use planes if necessary for chain irrigation at some point if you wanted to get irrigation to an adjacent city because it had access. The city that's got all this brown, all these planes, actually has access to a lake right there, whereas the city over there that's got some better terrain, you'd like to have some irrigation over there, and you don't want to wait until biology spread farm without irrigation. Before that, you could use farms to chain irrigate, get the irrigation over there.
Right.
And then erase those farms that you really didn't want anyway and change them to what you do want.
Now, the important thing, though, is to, whenever you're planting a lot of cities, try to not get all of one type of terrain in the city. The variety is definitely the spice of life.
Oh, yes.
Because a city that's all grassland or all one thing is really at a handicap because you can't shift your production. You can't, say, emphasize food first, then hammers, or hammers and then food, and adapt. Because the ability to move from your guys from one type of product to another, say, hey, I want to grow the city now, or I want to build units now, it gives you that flexibility. That flexibility is important.
If the brown tile has a forest in it, I'll usually keep the forest. I'm not sure if they're talking about if they have a forest, but usually it's just not worth making it into a plains tile. So unless I really need the hammers, I'll just keep the forest in there. And then maybe add a lumber mill later.
Mm. I really like lumber mills too.
Especially with railroad.
Mm. You can work those plains tiles with forest on them, and you will get some additional hammers from that. Most of the time, if I've got that many plains tiles, I'm worried about production capability because the city's not going to be able to grow very well in order to be able to get access to perhaps those tiles that I then have workshops on. So I don't often have workshops except in tundra, if I got any cities with tundra and forests on them. But yeah, that's another way to go about it if you have patience rather than turning them into a plain brown tile.
Oh, you're actually putting cities in tundra? Because I avoid that like the plague. I mean, only to get the particular resources in the tundra, really the only reasons to build up there.
Yeah, that's why I said if. That's very situational.
Ah, okay.
And it's usually end up being, oh, a guy snagged one or two tundra terrain because it happens to be, you know, north, south, and the rest of the terrain was nice in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, if there's this huge swath and it's just all plains and there's no food, what to do with plains? Just smile and nod.
Well, city raider or barrage?
This thread from Gory. Up until now, I've always gone with half of them barrage 1 and 2, and half of them barrage 1 and accuracy. But this last game, I went city raider 1 and 2 on almost all of them. Seemed like more of them survived. Am I just finally figuring out the obvious? Yes and no. If you're going on the offensive, and even I've only found this out recently, a bit to my own embarrassment, city raider is much better.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're using them to knock down the culture or the percentage in a really highly defended city, then you want the barrage and accuracy.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to disagree.
Yeah.
Up until recently, I would have agreed with you. But I have found that if you're going on the attack on the city, even take just a couple of catapults, have one that's on the barrage path and have another that's on the city attack path, compare the combat odds before using each one of those catapults. I have seen that, for instance, even with the accuracy we're getting plus 8%, that by using City Raider, you will hit many of the units and you will weaken them. They're sufficiently weak that the then cultural added percentage, since it's a percentage, of course, it's then a percentage of their weakened power. Let's say it's not promoted with accuracy. Let's just talk about you just got one promotion for your catapults, Barrage 1 or City Raider 1. If I use that barrage, I can go up a couple of percentage points, I find. Whereas if I use the City Attack 1, I could go up 15 to 20% odds right away. And this is, I'm talking ancient era, I'm talking specifically where I've seen this, horse archer units going up against cities that did not have spearmen in it, but still, on the offensive, city raider, even just try it for yourself. I think you'll be happier with the results than with barrage. It is true that your city raider catapults are more likely to die, lessen the chance of being able to use them again, but as long as you have sufficient numbers and you're being specific about what cities you're using the city raider for, the really nasty ones with the big stacks in it, it's worth it.
Occasionally I do go for barrage and then accuracy if I'm bombarding a city and I just want to go faster.
That's what I used to do constantly. I actually went barrage so I could get to accuracy.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
That is pretty important because you do a lot of just knocking down the defense bonus. That's 90% of what you're doing with catapults anyway, so why not make that go faster?
For me still, now, what I've seen what City Raider can do, I would still go the barrage and then accuracy route if I could, if there's the considerable tech disparity there. Which, yeah, I just want to knock down the cultural defense because if those are down, then I know my units are going to be able to more than sufficiently power to be able to take on the units themselves. I just got to get rid of that bloody cultural defense that's being a bug up the butt.
I guess it's more of a tactical thing. If you intend to attack with the catapults after you've done the bombarding, so as to get that additional weakening of the troops, because you need that in order to capture the city, then you go with the attack. Whereas if you're just going to say, hey, I got enough units in the back here that they're going to stomp the city after the catapults have done their job, and their job is only to barrage the city down, get the walls down, and then all the units will attack, then the city radio is useless. So it kind of depends on what your tactical situation is, which depends on how many catapults you've been able to produce, how tough of a city this is to attack, etc.
Yes, how many units you've got, what's the disparity between your technology and their technology in the units?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whether you can afford to lose the catapult.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess I was tending to think of siege units in terms of later on, because I usually have trebuchets. Do like early medieval stacks. So I have the trebuchets to bring the city down, and I have the catapults for sacrificing to get the percentage down so that the units can hit harder.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so city raider, unless I'm trying to like guard a city and maybe there's a stack of doom coming, maybe I'll do barrage. But other than that, city raider.
Something we talked about last season, and it actually got me thinking about how the way I play, which was holding off on promotions in particular situations, and I do that a lot with catapults. If I'm thinking I'm going to be going on the offensive, then right before I'm about to declare war, as I'm declaring war, whatever, then I go to the city raider. But if I find myself suddenly on the defensive, then I'm going barrage, and that saved me in a recent game, as a matter of fact. Barrage is excellent inside a city. Obviously, you want to use them as soon as the stack comes in, since they don't receive defensive bonuses. But, man, they can really, with the barrage, even just with barrage 1, can really soften up the stack of doom on your borders. So it's not so stack of doomy anymore. It goes from a stack of doom on the part of the person attacking you to a stack of dope.
Dope!
Now, there are other available promotions for catapults, but I think those are the two that you really want to focus on. There can always be situations where other ones come into play, but offense, city raider. Defense, barrage. Most of the time.
Drill when? Like when you're facing a bunch of archers? Or?
Yeah.
Someone had mentioned drill as well, and of course with drill you suffer 20% less collateral damage, but catapults don't suffer collateral damage, so... If you get to drill 4, you get plus 10% versus mounted units, but wow, that's a long way to go for that.
Wow.
And groceries from Flux. The big question here is, do you actually build these, and how many of these do you build? Lately, I always get annoyed by these buildings, quote-unquote, that discusses playing on epic speed, running caste system, or emancipation civics, and then later, quote, is it really worth it, unquote.
Banks, yes.
Yes, with respect to banks.
Groceries, not so much.
Really? I build groceries all the time. Is it just that you don't need the health bonus most of the time? Because I usually do at that point.
Yeah, it's good for the health bonus. I guess I'm looking at it more in terms of its commerce bonus, and that's when I could have a bank, I'd rather have a bank.
Oh, I see.
And I play England a lot, so I have stock exchanges.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, the plus 65% instead of 50, yes.
Yes.
For the cost of a bank gives more commerce bonus per hammer input than your groceries do. And the grocer's health bonus is dependent upon you having those resources. So if you got all the resources for the grocer, it's a little more attractive. And it's almost always good to put a grocer in a city that's got a high commerce. You're a very big gold city. Whereas your banks can be put in a lot more places and still be profitable. Though, of course, your big high commerce city has got a bank, too.
With banks, of course, you need X number of those, depending upon your map type, if I recall correctly, being the X number, in order to be able to build Wall Street for plus 100% gold, which obviously you want to do in your best commerce city.
Yeah.
And then with grocers, they're required to build supermarket. Not that I usually get to that point in the game when I could build supermarkets, yeah. But with supermarkets, plus one food. So if you're thinking, oh, man, if only the city had a little more food and it could work those, say, production tiles, well, you help with the health, which could also increase your food income, and then be able to get to supermarket as well. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, banks in your commerce cities, for certain, and then grocers more situation-dependent. I look at grocers for the health more than the gold income.
Same here.
Now, it is true that with both banks and grocers, they allow you to turn citizens into merchants. 3 for banks, 2 citizens for grocers, which is not that far behind, which is another consideration. But I would definitely build a bank first if I was thinking, I want to turn more of my citizens into merchants, plus having the bang for the buck.
The other consideration is that I usually get guilds before I get banking, because I usually want a knight or get to gunpowder pretty quickly. So that's another reason why I usually build grocers rather than banks, or build grocers more often than I do banks.
Yes, they can come earlier. Could also argue with, well, more longer term with grocers, You get the plus one health from bananas, spice, sugar, and wine. If you find you have more cows, deer, pigs, and sheep, you need a supermarket in order to be able to get plus one health for those, but in order to build the supermarket, you need to build grocers. So if you're thinking about health kind of longer term, then you could get it that way as well. But usually, yeah, by the time grocers come around, if I don't have those particular resources, I've tried to import those or some of them to be able to increase my health as well.
Yeah.
Do you bump AI from pleased to friendly? In single player, go into the world builder and... No, just kidding.
Offer them flowers.
I'd say if the AI is not going pleased with you, I would, like, ask them first nicely, and if they don't comply, just declare war on them. That's the solution. You agree, Maki, right? You know? It's like, well, if they're going to be rude to me and not be pleased, then I'll just declare war on them.
Well, since you hate me anyway, here's a reason to hate me more.
I hate you, I love you, I hate you, I love you.
Don't you love me? Don't you love me? No, then I hate you, I hate you.
I'm Isabella, I hate everyone.
Usually I go for the plus four from, quote, fair trade, unquote, when you give them a tech for, like, 100 gold or something, and they'll say our trade relations. If, like, the AP comes up, sometimes I'll just vote for somebody to get the you voted for us edition. Resources, too, I guess. Because you get some sort of bonus for training with them in the first place, but you also get a bonus that goes, like, we appreciate the years that you've supplied us with resources. Not sure at which point you get that.
That's a pretty small plus one, though, I think, dude, isn't it? It's not a big, big, oh, we love you, we love you, you know.
It's a little something.
Definitely the best one is to be the same religion as the AI is.
You know, is there a corresponding thing that when you actually cut them off of a resource that they've been having for a long time, they're like, we hate you for backstabbing and taking and denying us our strategic resources.
No.
They seem to not notice. And, of course, favorite civic and open borders. Open borders not as big. It's like plus two, right?
Yes. Yeah. Anytime that you could share a common war, there's nothing like having an AI perhaps that's close to you and comparable in power to you decides to go to war with somebody else who's not just lesser, preferably lesser, but on the other side of the continent or other side of the world can't get to you and says, join us in this war. Okay.
Yeah, I join that. I got your back, man.
Or even giving help. It depends in those situations. Usually giving help requires giving them a technology, and if they're demanding technology, I'll almost always say no.
I actually almost always say yes, because any more diplomacy points you can get, the better for me. Unless they're asking for something, gunpowder or something, yeah, usually I'll cave.
Yeah, the military tech, ooh, yeah.
Never trade military tech.
So that's, I think that's what you can do yourself. Random events, of course, can be good and bad. Can the good opportunity if you sometimes have sufficient gold in them. Now, some of those events, there's nothing you can do, like your diplomat caused a faux pas. There's nothing you can do about that. It just is.
Yeah, the old diplomatic faux pas.
But I think the best random event for helping people out is citizens in so-and-so place are starving.
Oh, yeah.
Got the gold. Send them to your food stores.
Yeah.
There's a post in here. It was from Blake. I don't know where they quoted it from earlier, and it's not up to date in terms of Beyond the Sword. It's the bastard chart, which gives them a bastard rating. The higher the total, the more likely they'll cause trouble and backstabbing you.
Is Shaka number one?
No, Ragnar is.
He just barely beat out Montezuma, which, of course, everyone expected to see up there. It's because Ragnar has a set of hair. Train that is likelihood to train military units. Well, Montezuma seems to be a bigger threat because he has a better economy than Ragnar. Ragnar's economy never was very strong, is it?
No, not really. I've never seen him becoming a powerhouse.
Yeah, with Ragnar, that'd be weird. I mean, Ragnar is aggressive financial.
Yeah, but Montezuma manages his economy very well. So when he declares war, there's usually a lot to attack you with.
I'd like to see an updated list that includes Beyond the Sword. Mostly because of the additional civs it adds, but I mean, some of the civs had their traits changed as well. I don't know how much that will impact it.
Gandhi is at the very bottom of the list. Complete wuss.
And he still backstabs you sometimes.
Hey, but it shows, you know, if you get backstabbed by India, you really deserved it. I mean, if you get backstabbed by Gandhi, you must have really had it coming.
So I guess that's the other thing, looking at that chart, taking that into account when you're trying to think of, man, how am I going to get friendly with this person? I've done this and this and that and that. or even, I was pleased you're even friendly. How come they just declared war on me after?
Just their name is Monty, yeah. I don't know if I agree with completely with the ranking, because they weighted all those categories the same.
Yes, yeah.
I'd probably weight war and train a lot more.
Yeah. So war pleased is their probability of declaring war on you when they are pleased, and it varies from 0 to 20%. Say Gandhi has a 0% chance, some other guys got 10%, and actually quite a number are at 20%, like Montezuma. But he also has a 75% backstab rating, which combining the two of those is pretty unique. Not very many other people have that as well. In fact, only Catherine. But Montezuma has 100% war attitude versus only 50% for Catherine. That makes sense.
How do they define backstab in this case?
Probability of shamelessly dogpiling.
Ah.
That's a technical term. Okay. Came right from the XML right there.
Yes, there's a factor in there. I shameless dogpile percentage int, you know. And it's like 100%, 80%, and that's pretty much how it works. And it's like, if attack value is greater than shameless dogpile percentage equals attack now. I guess they make a difference between a dogpile war and a just plain war. So dogpile war is just pure opportunisticness on the AI's part versus one driven by its feelings towards you.
Yes, actually that post is part of another thread, which was AI Attitude Explained, started by Ori, who referred that post from Blake. Because after reading it, I was like, oh yeah, what are all the different values that come into play in terms of the diplomatic modifiers that could get you from pleased to friendly? So I went looking, and that's what I found.
Yeah. But the lesson with these backstabbers and these dogpilers is that your rating doesn't matter with them, so don't bother.
Yeah.
I mean, are you really going to expend all of that effort, all of the goodies, all the things you have to give them, to know that even at pleased, they have a 20% chance of declaring war at you at any time? It's like, not worth it.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Carta Mandua had been a regular co-host for about the past year and a half, but she has left the show, so we are currently looking for a fourth regular co-host. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Carta Mandua for putting up with Imran, Mackie, and I, especially Imran, over the past year.
Well, this has been Polycast, episode 75. Our co-hosts have been Dan Q, Makalula, Imran Siddiqui, Impaler, Metalla Turtle, and me, QNL, or Lisa.
We also have Lisa, QNL.
Oh my god. I don't want to do that.
We're keeping it.
Yay. No, please, I beg you.
That was awesome.
And I'd like to thank you for a funny blooper.
Let's try that again.
Say that's good again, Dan.
He's all, yeah, that was good.
No, Mackie, say that again.
No, not helping you out with your evil editing powers.
All right, summaries? Or no, wait.
Yes, summaries, yes.
We didn't already do them, did we?
No, we did not.
I'll do research lab. Actually, no, I'll do forum talk. All right, in forum talk, we talked about lost infrastructure when capturing a city. Whether we should...
Wait. Did you just say capturing a city?
Well, I guess I did then. I don't know. Wait, what's going on this podcast?
Is it normal?
I hope not.
Yes.
For us.
Yeah. What?
Record date?
August 8th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communication at civcom.net.